something and I'll have started 30 minutes late and I'm like, oh man, I really wish I had the previous 30 minutes of this conversation because, you know.
Happens all the time. Happens all the time.
I'm pretty new to all of this. So it's kind of, I didn't realize how good the, you know, the lead up could be. And I also don't really know how, like whenever you get into one of these kinds of things, like how quickly someone's expected to get into whatever you're going to be talking about, you know, it's like come in hot and then, you know.
I find most people who are talking about this stuff on YouTube want to talk. And so they jump right in and off you go. So I do almost no editing on my channel. Mm-hmm. Just here it is. If you want to watch it, watch it. I'm not going to leave anything out. All the ums, the uhs, the little, I mean, you get that in the New Testament with, you know, and by the way, bring the parchments, Paul says.
I do like that uncut, like conversation style, you know, because it's like very, it's very authentic and like you can, I feel like it's more true and like you get more genuine conversations, less scripted. Yeah. It's like, I care more about that than like, it's kind of like, I think like it's some version of like Plato's idea where like you act your beliefs out. And like by that, he said something like, by a man's play, I'll deduce his philosophy or something like that, you know, where it's like, I like to see people in the real talking about what they believe as opposed to something they could spend, you know, who know a year scripting out and then recording and like that kind of thing is more interesting to me.
Well, maybe because you edit, you can edit this out, but why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself? James from Modern Day Debates, you know, had the hookup. And so just tell me a little bit about yourself, why you're doing a podcast and what it's about. And then after that, you can pepper me with questions.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I kind of started, my blog, which is called Tweaking Optimism. I started it, I guess you could say more officially a year ago, but I technically been working on something in some variation of it since 2014. And even maybe before then, it had gone through several iterations and name changes where I was just like trying to write something, trying to like, I couldn't really put my finger on what I wanted to do. And then finally, like, I have a history of mental illness and then like same with my family, mental illness, substance abuse, et cetera. Like it's very, like peppered throughout my family. And then, so it was just like, at least within the past two generations. So it was just like, sort of like, philosophical inclination, psychological inclination, like this kind of like a tendency to like read big books for fun kind of thing. And so like, and that really began with my dad, who was like very well read and all that, which a slight caveat, he's actually, I'm his caretaker and he's in the hospital. And so I may at some point have to take a phone call.
Okay.
Just that's as cool. I don't know that that will happen, but just on the odd chance that
some
does
homeless
happen.
Person might knock at my door. So that's happens all the time. So,
okay. Excellent.
Not a problem.
I'm glad you understand. Excellent. And so I was trying to, in some sense, like, and so I also, kind of grew up in like sort of a misfit crowd. And then like those, so that kind of like, physiological predisposition, like my own, illnesses common to my family. And then also like my intellectual, like predisposition to read books and think about things the way that I do, kind of in one way I felt coalesced, especially with like the stuff that you are doing. And then kind of similar with like, the stuff with like Jordan Peterson and then, I believe John Vervaeke. And like, just, and like that sort of IDW sphere, kind of like also was like precipitating. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, maybe the beliefs that I hold about the world affect the way that I feel and can affect like my ability to, internalize things and understand things and interact with people. And so, and then I began to notice more and more that like people were feeling like, super, like there's a general sense of meaninglessness, you know, like there's a general sense of like, people are like, you know, I don't know what I'm here for. I think there's a common meme going on right now where like, it says something like, we're here to, eat, sleep and be in pain until we die or something like that. And it was like, I feel like there's very clearly so much more to that, but people, you know, like people resonate so much with this guy. Well, I don't know, probably like 500,000 shares or something, you know, it's hard to tell how many times that's been shared or seen, but like just the one I saw had several hundred thousand likes or whatever, you know? And so I wanted to in some way address it, you know, maybe from like a personal level, but also from like talking with people who had, I found like in my own life, looking at people who were, I would consider admirable, you know, like who were like heroes essentially, you know, throughout history, you know, like, or that they did something amazing, you know? And so like, we don't know who's going to be doing amazing things right now necessarily. Some people we do, we can very clearly see, ah, yeah, that guy was going to be in the history books. But then there are other people who are more obscure, you know, like there's a poet who wrote this poem called The Hound of Heaven. I don't know if you ever heard of that poem. But it's like super, it's very, very popular poem. And that guy was like a homeless heroin addict, you know? And so it's like, it's very difficult to know who is going to be that, you know, that next great poet or that next great physician or that next great insert discipline here, you know? And so it's like, I just kind of treat every person as if they're that next big person and interview them and talk with them about the types of stuff that's going on, you know, because like it's people like, man, I'm drawing a blank on his name that wrote The Hound of Heaven, but it's kind of like, I'll use other people's names like Soren Kierkegaard or, you know, Thomas Aquinas or C.S. Lewis or Tolkien or all these people who like did really, really difficult things, you know, or did and even did things under pain and suffering, you know, like the idea like that, like Tolkien and Lewis grew up in the world wars and were still writing under the threat of death, basically, you know. And I always think of C.S. Lewis's essay Learning in Wartime, where he, you know, he's talking to young guys at college, like, you know, it's still important to read books, it's still important to do your duty to you know, to God and country, kind of thing, like to actualize your gifts, you know. And and so that's kind of why I started doing this. And then also it's kind of also in conjunction with, I want to talk with people who are interesting and interested in similar things, because in my personal life, there are very few people who are who are interested and willing to talk for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours about any number of obscure things that I might be interested in, or any number of, you know, books like that I might read. I have one friend that is that reads like I read, but apart from him, it's I, you know, like for instance, we were reading The Idiot by Dostoevsky, and it's like I don't know anyone else that has read that book personally, you know.
Really?
I don't know a single person who has read Dostoevsky or even knows who he was.
Did you go to college?
I'm in college right now, kind of, okay. But I, since I'm my dad's caretaker, it's taken me a long time to do that. Cause I became his caretaker when I was 24, and I'm only 25 now, but it's like been an untraditional route. But even in college, I don't find anybody that's in the same vein of understanding, like, or like is in the same vein of interests, doing a psychology degree. And I'd like to become a clinician myself, but, even like the people that are in there, in some sense, like a lot of them are very one track, and unfortunately a lot of them are, more like, I don't know what the word is, but like, they're more just inclined to social justice than anything else for whatever reason, you know. Like they're more interested in learning about how to diversify the field rather than further the field. And so it's like, that's also like, there's not a lot of good conversations. And then on top of that, right now, due to COVID, everything is online as well.
Yeah.
So I kind of just, I talked for a while, but I don't know
that's
if there's
okay.
anything that
that's okay.
prior interest.
Well,
there.
No, it is. Well, I'm always, I got into this game. Well, so the complaint that you just made is very common, because even if you go out on the internet and you look at Reddit or Twitter, you can find lots of people who have read Plato or Kierkegaard and are mm-hmm. interested in these things, but they're a small percentage of the population. And so they tend to be scattered and distributed, and they can find each other on the internet. And when the Jordan Peterson wave came through, that wave sort of surfaced a lot of those people, especially around meaning issues. And people were quite frustrated because they wanted conversation partners. And the internet is sort of a way to do this. And with YouTube now, we kind of have a tool to find each other and to do these conversations in a better way than, let's say, if you and I were talking on the phone, this would be less rich. So this thing has sort of grown up because of the technology, but there've long been people out there. And again, you could tend to find them in churches or universities, but not all churches, obviously. A lot of churches are busy with other things. So there have been ways that people have been able to find each other to have conversations about these kind of things, but it's not easy. The portion of the population is small. So then I started a meetup, and that's been cool, and YouTube channel, and that's been cool. So that's kind of how it went for me.
Yeah. That idea, like the, with the technology developing, like I had talked with someone about this where like even in my own case where it's like for instance, I'm the only person in my environment that reads Kierkegaard, Aquinas, Dostoevsky, et cetera. Previously that would just be it. I would never, like, unless I traveled somewhere, you know, to the university or traveled to, you know, wherever all of that was going on, you know, that would just be it. I would just be the only person there, you know, or likewise, like, previously, like when kids were growing up playing football or sports or whatever, like there was no way to get on Instagram and see how good you were in comparison to 2 billion other people, you know, or how, like, I frequently kind of, in some ways I freak out because when I go somewhere and I start reading with other people who have read these works, I'm like, oh my gosh, I literally, how can I keep up with them? Like, they're so, how do I, you know, I don't know half of what they know, or I can't make half the references they make, you know, and like, it freaks me out, you know? But in reality, it's like, I don't know what their profession is. They could literally, that could be their job, you know, like maybe they are a professor somewhere and like, that's what they do. And like, in another case, they could be, you know, they could have been studying this. Maybe it's not their job, but maybe they're, you know, 80 years old and they've been reading this for 40 years, you know, it's one of those things that's like, it's that comparison, global comparison, or the globalizing of comparison is like, I think it's a bad thing personally, but like, it's also like, it can be a good thing, I guess. Maybe we'll make more, I guess technologically it's good, but maybe like in some, like, I don't know how you say, maybe like humanistic or metaphysical way, it's bad ultimately, like to sort of like make people progress more rapidly than what was previously considered natural. I don't know, but I guess the human being knows no bounds in some sense. Like, you know, like we kind of have been adjusting. What Dostoevsky's like, I think it was Dostoevsky who said the human being is the man who can grow used to anything or something like that, you know, so yeah, I wonder, I guess we'll grow used to this as well, but I don't like getting used to it.
Taking notes as I go. I always take notes.
Yeah, I likewise.
So what are your questions? What do you want to talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's see. How exactly did you get started? You're a minister, a pastor. And then, like, typically people will make, at least from my experience, because I'm also a Christian, and I read the types of things I read, they sometimes label me an anomaly. They don't find me to be a Bible thumper. Do you find that, like, how did you get into what you're doing as a minister? And then, like, do people sort of find you to be like an anomaly? Do people think what you do is weird, basically?
Yes. Yes. Well, I've I am who I am, just like Popeye. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I've always been interested in ideas and thought. I mean, all the way, I'm in my mid-50s now, but all the way back to college years. As a local pastor, being a pastor is a very interesting profession because you can take it a lot of different directions, and many pastors do. You get the opportunity to study a particular text each week, prepare lessons. You deal with people in their personal lives, so you get a very close observation of human nature. And you usually have a degree of freedom with respect to your time. There's an expectation that you'll be doing some study. So I was a missionary in the Dominican Republic after my seminary training. I was that for a number of years. And then I came to Sacramento, California to pastor this small church. And I've always enjoyed, well, I'm dyslexic, which hasn't helped in reading necessarily. When audiobooks came out, that was a huge thing. I've been a fan of podcasts, and I've always been an auditory learner. Anything that a professor would say in class, I would remember. If I had it to get it only out of a book, I struggled. So a number of years ago when I started blogging, because in some ways the same, in experiencing the same thing that you did, looking for other people who were interested in the kinds of things that I was, and the internet sort of lended itself to that. And so I also discovered that I did a lot of writing on listservs and on my blog, just to sort of work out ideas. I continue to read books. I'm also, as I was talking to Ryan Bennett earlier this week, I'm a digger. When I hear an idea, I want to know where the idea comes from and what makes the person with that idea tick. So, and it's always wrapped up in my own personal life too. I mean, all of our lives are. So in the mid aughts, I really dug deep into Tim Keller. I found, I'd gotten to a dry, burned out place, but I didn't have the kind of five kids. So I didn't have the kind of family situation where I could just say to my family, oh, I'm burned out right now. I'm going to stop doing this job. And so I had to, in a sense, I had to dig for water. And so I did a lot of digging into Tim Keller to try and figure out what was going on in New York City after 9/11 with the explosion of Redeemer Presbyterian. Why was Tim Keller getting the kind of responses he was getting? And I was on that for a number of years, and then sort of lost interest and became a general forager again. I'd started reading the blog of Rod Dreher because I was kind of curious about what was happening in that culture space. And Jordan Peterson came up on the radar screen there. And I thought, why would a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto be kvetching about non-binary pronouns? At that point, my kids were in high school and I was surrounded by lots of kids with non-binary pronouns, changing their names all the time. And, you know, these were my kids' friends and they were in my home all the time and they slept on my couch. And, you know, I loved these kids. They were, you know, they're kids, but nobody, when I went to high school, changed their pronoun or changed their name. And it's like, well, what's going on with that? And so then Jordan Peterson is digging in about this. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I start, and I think, well, maybe he's some evangelical who somehow, you know, was able to keep tenure in a university. And then I noticed he was doing a biblical series. I thought, wow, maybe he really is a Christian who's just a conservative Christian in a misplaced in a blue state place, even though Canada isn't blue state. And then I listened to his biblical lectures and thought, no, this is a totally different animal. And some of the stuff he said about the Bible, I thought he doesn't have any formal education in the Bible. That much is fairly true. I mean, he's using Blue Bible and Bible Hub to get his information and commentaries in public domain. But at the same time, a lot of his other ideas were fresh and interesting and stimulating. And I found this very much stimulating me. And then I I was reading Reddit or comment section or something, and someone was saying, yeah, I used to be into Tim Keller and now I'm totally into Jordan Peterson. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because Jordan Peterson and Tim Keller are in very different spaces. But in a sense, what they have in common is that they're deep into thinking about things and thinking about things creatively and presenting it in new, fresh ways. And I began to notice all of this other stuff going on around Jordan Peterson. And I was using my normal channels to try and drum up conversation partners and being a little bit frustrated. And I was also rereading Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death at the time, thinking about media. And I'd for a long time had thought about doing more writing, but had never really been able to get into a disciplined groove of doing longer works. And I looked around my congregation, I thought, if I wrote a book, no one here would read it. They don't read books, at least the kind of books that I would want to write. And a lot of the books that people in church are reading, I don't like to read. And so I wouldn't like to write it. I would hate myself writing it. So then I thought, well, what about video? So I started playing around with video, and then a member of my church who's on disability for mental illness says, you know, Pastor Paul, why don't you and me do a TV show? It's like, how's that going to work? He'd been down to public access, and I thought, I'm not going to traipse down to public access at some weird time in my calendar. So I said, Freddie, I'll tell you what, I'll use my smartphone and we'll make little 5-minute shows and I'll post them on YouTube, because I'd used YouTube to post sermons and just play around with it, and thought, I'll post it there and I'll post it to Facebook, and 10 or 15 people from the church who know us both will watch it sometime. And so that's how the Freddie and Paul show started. And then Jordan Peterson came up, and I was watching this and I thought, there's something about this with YouTube. YouTube is an important thing and an important change in our capacity to find each other and talk. And I've got some thoughts about Jordan Peterson's biblical series. I think Jordan Peterson's important. And I think Jordan Peterson's important missiologically and culturally. And I want to talk about Jordan Peterson. And so I'll make a video. Why not? And so I'd been playing around with different things. And so I made a video. And, you know, like 2 days later, I had 300 YouTube subscribers. And I thought, well, I didn't expect that. Well, they'll stop. And then I had 500 and thought, this is a little troubling. It's exciting, but troubling. And then I had 1,000, and then I had 2,000. And you can even find the video where I said, okay, that's enough. I don't want any more than 2,000, because I don't want this messing up my life. But then, you know, I wanted to talk to people. And then I found that people wanted to talk to me, like we're doing now. And so I start talking to people on Zoom and on Skype, and I'm thinking, boy, this person should talk to this person. And so I started asking people, can I record this? Can I share this? And people are like, well, okay. And sometimes it was appropriate and sometimes it wasn't. So then I kept making YouTube videos, because I was getting what I wanted in terms of conversation partners, more than I expected. And then I start getting this flood of emails, and I'm like, well, this wasn't what I expected, but I can't turn these people away. I'm a pastor. I don't turn people away. I talk to homeless people and whoever comes around, but there's just lots of them. So I have to figure out how to handle this. So one thing led to another, and I start posting conversations, and then people are watching the conversations. Then people are wanting to get on the channel for a conversation. And then we start a local meetup of people in Sacramento who wanted to talk about Jordan Peterson, and people keep coming to that, and new people keep coming to that. And just on and on and on and on and on. And I'm still, if Jordan Peterson had a big wave that crested and fell, obviously, because of his wife's illness and his illness, my wave has just sort of been slow. It you know, there was kind of an initial wave when Jordan was scored. I was kind of in his draft. I was awake behind his wave. But it's continuing to go on. And for me, I mean, my monologue videos, as I call them, they're just thinking out loud, because I get stimulated by the comment sections. We started a Discord server. I get stimulated by that and by the community and by conversations like this. And so I just keep going, and it's fun, and it's stimulating for my ministry. And I want to, you know, I both want to figure out how this medium can be useful for local ministry and for ministry in general, but also this other estuary project that I'm interested in, the concept of, we need to have, like earlier this week, I had a terrific conversation with Ryan Bennett, and, you know, he's a, was kind of a Sam Harris atheist, and now he's not so much, but he's still an atheist. And we had a terrific conversation because I want to know how they think. I want to know what they think. So that's my story. That's how I got here.
Oh, that's, wow. Yeah. So it's kind of, was there any, were you all interested in these types of things, like before the sort of Jordan Peterson phenomenon, like as a kid, were you always like, kind of like when I was a kid, I was labeled the nerd, basically, you know, like everyone was like, they once tried to give me the nickname Webster, 'cause I like to just read dictionary and get big words. And like my dad would use big words, and like would use, sometimes he'd use French and German and things like that occasionally. And like, I kind of like started using these big words. And so were you ever like that as a kid? Did you ever,
Bit. I was dyslexic, so reading was onerous for me. But I liked ideas, and I was a nerd. So, you know, I didn't date girls in high school, and I played Dungeons and Dragons with my friends, and I liked Tolkien, and I liked Dune, and, you know, so I was that kind of nerd. But, you know, I wasn't particularly good at sports. So yeah, I was a nerd, but I wasn't a bookworm.
Yeah, to be fair, I never read a book. Well, let's see. I read maybe one book a year for like school or something like that. But I did play a lot of video games and like, things like that. Like, I think by the time I was 19, I had 4 years of time logged in video games. So I had spent 4 full years of my life just burnt, World of Warcraft, League of Legends, those kind of computer games, like, 'cause the time is logged there. So I could literally see, there goes, that was 4 years of my life. And now when I think back on that, I'm like, oh my God, 4 years, 4 full years. Like that, like imagine, like just sitting here for 4 years and just staring at the screen for 4 years.
Yeah.
That's like, that's so, upsetting to me, because like you can do so much with 4 full years of time. It's like 40,000 hours or something. Like, it's a lot of time, you know. Like, it's
they didn't have those when I was young. We had Pong. You couldn't spend 4 years with Pong.
No, that is where I started, though. I did start, I was 4 years old, and I started with Atari 2600 with the knobs, you know. Me and my sister would play Pong. And then it just, when I was 6, I started using computer. And then from there, it's been history. But it was kind of beneficial in some sense. It did help me. Like, most of my skills are self-taught. And I was able to work at an engineering engineering firm for like 4 years, testing software, which was really great. Gave me like a lot of experience. But like, all my skills were just developed because I basically, like, as a kid, like we didn't have like a nice computer. I mean, I was born in 95, and so 2000, like the computers, I think my first computer, or the first computer I had access to, had 256 megabytes of RAM, which was probably for that time pretty fast, but just like troubleshooting the computer so I could play more video games, basically. You know? Yeah. You had kind of mentioned like your desire for these conversations and your interest in Jordan Peterson. Do you think that like, and so you're kind of like, I don't know if you'd say this about yourself, but maybe you're kind of in touch with like the prevailing opinion, maybe like the zeitgeist, if that's the right term to use, when it comes to sort of this like idea that I kind of maybe mentioned earlier of the lack of meaning in people's lives individually. How recent do you think the trend is, I guess? Because for my whole life, as far as I can remember, I've seen it, or at least the people that have been around me have experienced it. And I myself have experienced it. I guess if there was a date or an event that you could attribute to that sort of spread, where do you think it started, or where do you think that kind of began?
I think it's been in the culture for a while. I personally mm-hmm. never experienced it, partly because as a Christian and as a committed Christian from a deeply Christian family, we always had a mission. We always mm-hmm. had meaning. And so in many ways, that kind of Christian is always looking for people lacking meaning, saying, hey, here's a meaning, go run with this. You can run with this your whole life long, and it'll be less of a waste than World of Warcraft. So somebody mentioned to me recently, said, you know, I don't think a lot of Christians have meaning crises. And I think that's true, because religion, at least if you're fully embedded in a religion that isn't too contaminated or cross-pressured with secularization, it's a deeply meaningful thing. Now, this materialist nihilism, you know, when I listen to, let's say, Sam Harris's conversation with Brett Weinstein, you know, Sam, I get the sense Sam is on a mission. But when I think about the philosophical underpinnings of his mission, I can see why most people aren't, because this kind of weird duality between a strange determinism and then, you know, living in the manifest image of, well, we've got to, our mission is to get people off of the stupid drug of religion. Well, there he's getting his meaning, but he doesn't have a philosophical system that really affords it. And so as a dramatically unsuccessful Christian minister, I was mostly surrounded by Christian people who weren't having a meaning crisis. But when I began, you know, as I began getting into the people that were attracted to Jordan Peterson, you know, it was about a year into it, I began to notice that a lot of the people coming to me have had histories of depression, some suicidal ideation, and watching Jordan Peterson is making them better. And it's like, well, that's interesting. Why would watching videos of this rambly Canadian psychologist relieve people of depression? And then you begin to recognize, well, what's causing this depression? We've so medicalized depression that, you know, it's just silly. And even though there's very much a medical aspect to it, but why would watching Jordan Peterson relieve depression? Well, then I watched Verveke, and he's much more into terms of this meaning crisis, and he and Christopher Mastropietro's, you know, symptomology of the meaning crisis. And it's like, oh, I see. And I'd had tastes of that myself. I had read C.S. Lewis's book Miracles about once or twice a year if I felt sort of the siren song of naturalists, of naturalism or materialism kind of tweaking up the doubt quotient in my own mind. And after seeing Jordan Peterson and understanding what John Verveke was doing, I could see it much more clearly. I was sort of divorced from it, though, because I was deeply embedded in the church and the Christian community.
Yeah, I think because I became a Christian later, well, in my 20, when I turned 20, actually, well, just before my 21st birthday. And so, like, before that, I was more on the edge of, like, here's a statement I would say back then. I like Jesus. He's fine, but I can't get on board with the teachings of, I can't get on board with the Old Testament or even some of the New Testament bits. And so in that sense, I regard him as like a wise teacher, like maybe the Buddha or, you know, one of the, those Taoists or whatever, you know, the Jains, whatever, like those, I was more in that sense, like a New Age. Like I never once thought, like I wasn't a, well, one, I never read a philosophy book in my life at that time. So it wasn't an intellectual conviction that I had that, and nor had I even read through the Bible at that point. Like I didn't have an intellectual conviction in either direction. I wasn't like, oh, I read this and this is garbage. Or I read these books by David Hume and Sam Harris and whatever. And like, I agree with them. And like, they totally dispelled my Christianity for me. But instead I had some sort of like, C.S. Lewis might call it like Christianity in water, you know? So I had like this, our life force philosophy. I had this nebulous idea of the universe that could in some way intervene in my life or had been intervening in my life. And there was some notion of faith or destiny. And so I think that, I don't like, and I think Jordan Peterson gets in trouble for saying something like this or has, and a lot of people got upset with him, but he's like, oh, there aren't any atheists, because they don't act out that belief of atheism. They don't act like Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment, essentially, you know, or they don't, they're not, you know, they still hold on to these sort of like under these diluted Christian beliefs, at least, you know, you could say like, and I think more and more people are noticing that, like with the advent of like people, you know, that were calling themselves Christian atheists now or whatever, you know, like it's kind of, it was almost, I imagine like when C.S. Lewis talked about being the unwilling convert coming kicking and screaming into the kingdom of God, I imagine in some sense, like a lot of atheists are being, are coming kicking and screaming into like Christian culture, essentially. Like they are waking up and realizing like, this is like in Tom Holland's book, Dominion, this is sort of the fishbowl, or this is the water in the fishbowl rather, you know, like it's sort of inevitable, at least in the West, because it's so saturated with Christian ideals. That's what you get. And so I think maybe I think for a while, like Christianity and water worked for a lot of people. Like they didn't, there wasn't like, they could kind of get on this sort of slurry of like a few bits of virtue and like do good things. And then also like, you have some destiny or there's some fate, something out there that could do something for you, or does things for you whenever good things happen. But when bad things happen, we don't talk about that. Like maybe the universe is angry at you. And I think maybe that worked for a while, but I think like it was an unsustainable, like, you know, I think it just got too diluted basically or something, you know? And so then they were just left with water, and then they had, you know, I think in some sense, like, well, now depression, anxiety, suicide, those are on the rise. And like, especially in young people, you know, and like when you had said, you talked about making depression more of a physical thing, more of like a chemical imbalance, or, you know, you have to go and get these drugs administered to you. Like that's, that is a problem, especially when like I'm in a clinical psych class right now, and they say, you know, exercise is the best medication, or just like, and now the big thing is cognitive behavioral therapy. And all of a sudden they found that it has virtually the same success rate as prescription medication, you know? And so if you exercise and do CBT, and CBT is basically, parts of the Christian mission in some sense, you know, like I think that there's strong ties to CBT and like the imitation of Christ or something like that, you know, where it's like you have to examine yourself, your thoughts, and then your behaviors, you know? So it's like, I think in some sense it's G.K. Chesterton would call it the long way home, basically, you know, like, I don't know if you ever read his book, Man Alive, but
I haven't read Man Alive.
Man Alive is my favorite book. I read it and then I immediately read it again because it's so amazing. It's about a guy named Innocent Smith, and he goes into his house. Like, for instance, it's a lot of different stories, but one of the stories is he's trying to get into his house. But to keep his perspective fresh, he goes in a different way every time. So he may break in through the window or the chimney. and so, and his wife just kind of puts up with it. He's like, oh, that's just Innocent Smith. Like, like, and he's taking someone with him and he's like breaking in through the window and like, you have to walk very quiet. And like the guys with him is like, are we breaking in this guy's house? You know? And then he finds out that it's his house, you know? And then part of that story is he wants to go in through the back door. So he goes around the world to go through the back door, basically. and all the while there's poems along the way. He goes to like China and meets a guy fishing, and you know, he tells poems to each person, you know, I'm looking for the immutable house, the house of red on the hill that shines in the light and provides hope and comfort to all men who seek it. And like things like that, you know, and like people are like, what, this guy's crazy. And it turns out he's just going through his back door, you know. But I think that's in some sense what may inevitably happen, you know. Like, well, we've gone through this phase of Christianity and water. It has to, in some sense, I don't want to say die. I don't know that it could ever really die, because there are some people living in the body that truly exemplify Christian virtue, Christian values, the pursuit of Christ and things like that. But then there's like, I think in some sense, like the sun has to set, and then I don't know what will happen at that point, but I would think that if history is going to continue and something else doesn't happen, or another, you know, some other unforeseen event, then we'll eventually find our way home in that sense, maybe. And I think in some, Jordan Peterson played a big part in that revelation, maybe.
Well, I think it's very true that, and it's interesting to me that psychology is an area where this is coming up in. There have always been bigger questions around psychology, but it has become a practice of sort of making people, in some ways, making people compliant and docile, because that's sort of what we want. So one of the things that I came into, well, so my father was a pastor in a poor community in Paterson, New Jersey. And there, one of the things that you get in the United States in poor communities is America stratifies via income levels. And if you're struggling with mental illness, if there's racial issues, you know, you'll tend to get into the poor communities, people will settle. And so I grew up with a lot of individuals in my father's church who were dealing with serious mental illness. And then when I came to this church, I found it as well. And so I began, not only had I had a history of dealing with people who were struggling with mental illness, and sometimes hilariously so, and often tragically so, and then here in this church as well. And what I began to discover is that they were embedded in a medical establishment that, okay, so the medical establishment was terrifically well-meaning, but at some point you have to ask the question, what is the straight stick? What is the agenda of this medical establishment for these people? And in many ways, the agenda is have them not cause trouble. And, you know, then I see it in schools, and I begin to realize, well, that's sort of the program in schools too. We like children who are compliant and who say yes and who go along with whatever program. I mean, my wife's a school teacher, but school teachers are often little tyrants. I mean, their classes are little tyrannies. And so if the country could get away with it, you know, I would get the sense that part of what many would like to do is just simply emasculate people on, first it was television, and now it's the internet and video games, and just We have too many people with too many ideas and they cause too much trouble. So if they can't be productive in terms of making us all more wealthy, at least keep them quiet. And I see that all the time. And it's like, is that what a human being is for? And churches are in some ways the same way. What do churches want? Churches want docile, compliant, yes people, and people who pastors want, you know, crowds of people who applaud the pastor, and that can't be right.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. It's like there are a lot of like parallels I can see in my mind. In some sense, it's like we're like trying to lop off the margins for some reason because those outliers make us uncomfortable.
Yeah,
I think someone said something like, if there was a Socrates alive today, we would have him reeducated in an instant. You know, like we would cure him of his genius, basically. You know, and like it also kind of in some sense reminds me of like the Grand Inquisitor and Dostoevsky's, yeah. You know, where like they're like, oh, Jesus, you can't come back now. Like we have this great system going. Like you're just going to ruin it. Like we have to. I'm sorry, but you'll understand. Like we need this. Like we've got a system. Sorry. Like, you know, and I agree. Like we've been anesthetized or immunized from brilliance, from original thought, creativity, activity in some senses, like what with the rising rates of like obesity and weight related illnesses, you know, like things like that. Like we're literally going to just become like very, I don't know what a good parallel is, but just very, like, just like you're saying, very compliant, very like, yes, yes, yes. Like doing exactly what we're told to do, you know, like, there'll be no radicals, or maybe there will be radicals still, but there'll certainly be fewer of them, you know?
Well, even the radicalism is domesticated, you know,
true.
You watch Steve Jobs. I mean, one of the most popular commencement addresses, Steve Jobs at Stanford saying, you know, buck dogma. And everyone's like, yeah, buck dogma. It's like, yeah. Hasn't that become the dogma?
I mean, yeah. seriously.
Is nobody paying attention? I listened to that. I grew up in a Christian community, and the commencement addresses in Christian schools, they had their own liturgies and their own repetitions and their own compliances and their own boring qualities too. It was all just usually the Christian chatter. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, here in California, my kids went to public school and I'm going to these commencement addresses and like, well, this is, they're not that different from the Christian. They say very different things, but they're all saying it. It's like, I don't believe in dogma. Oh yeah. And that's your dogma. And, you know, and so then suddenly you're in the strange position of saying, well, what actually would be fresh? And is it just fresh for me? Why is it that we recognize genius or something worthwhile listening to? And you know, it's deeply mysterious, but somehow we know we can't live without it. And somehow when we recognize that we've just spent, you know, 4 years of our life playing a video game, we begin to say, maybe I wouldn't have done that again.
yeah, absolutely. Like, and there's no way that like now I would ever do that, like what I did again, you know, like, cause I was so dim. Like when I think back to the time, I feel physically dim. I think about the thoughts that I had at that time in my life, and it's like they were so rudimentary. Like, how do I get this item in this game? How do I, am I going to have time like after school? Like, what am I going to do? Like that kind of thing, you know? And like, now they're so, my thoughts are so different. Like the thoughts that I have just on a daily basis, you know, like, now I'm not saying that they're enlightened thoughts or that I feel in some way more enlightened. I am maybe to my former self, of course, but like, as far as like the standard of the world, maybe like if you know, if you had a measuring stick and we were comparing everybody, I don't rank on there, but at least I can tell, you know, that dimness. And I think in some sense, like because I went to public school a lot too, and just the curriculum in public school, at least where I'm from in Missouri, St. Louis, I think this maybe is a more general thing in America, but like the idea is heavy STEM, you know, science, technology, you know, that type of thing. Like that's the big thing. It's like, there's a big engineering school in Missouri, RAWA or Missouri S&T. And like, everyone's like, engineer, technology, like that kind of thing. And like, it's almost like, in the pursuit of science and technology, we forgot all the humanities. Basically, we left them lying on the nursery floor, you know, with like fairy tales and stuff like that. And so like now people only value if you can produce a electric car or a new cell phone or, you know, a faster processor or, you know, whatever, like, but less and less, I think we're valuing. And I think in large part to our education system. And I think in some sense, like people who aren't taught about, I don't know, like people aren't taught poetry, literature, philosophy, religion, are certainly more, what'd you say? Like anesthetized. They're just more, less likely to have these, you know, less likely to find themselves in the margin, basically, you know, like, yeah. Because like all the great people that I've ever read, I recently read a book by Richard Feynman, and he hated, like the humanities, the soft sciences. He did not like them at all. You know, he's a theoretical physicist. He's like, he talked about in this book how he basically like, he had to write a theme on Faust, but he just made a mockery of it, but it still got high marks because he's a genius, you know, but you know, but he was still exposed to Faust. I don't know if I said Faust to anybody that anyone would know. Certainly no one I went to school with. I would bet there's one guy I know who would know what Goethe's Faust was, but I don't know that anyone else would. Yeah. And not saying that that's like the benchmark, but like maybe if someone knew who Wordsworth or Milton or Keats or anybody, any poet, any philosopher, any novelist, any writer, like, I think that our education in large part has been used, like you've been saying, to make us, I don't know if you'd say, well, weak, I guess. I don't know if you've ever watched Solzhenitsyn's commencement speech to Harvard, but he literally just gets up there and says, the West is weak and will not oppose anybody. Like, you've grown fat and lazy, basically, you know. Yeah. It's like, and in some sense, like,
yeah. No, there's a lot of truth to that. And you can spot it. I remember in one of my, so again, I was dyslexic, so I tended to watch a lot of PBS stuff, documentaries, interested in ideas. And I remember when Ken Burns' Civil War documentary came out, listening to the kinds of letters that 19th century people would write. I remember as a kid, my grandfather was a minister and tended to have churches that were in the rural Midwest. I mean, really tiny, out of the way places. And so my father would go to these one room or nearly one room schoolhouses. And this is, you know, in the middle part of the 20th century. I mean, there's still places that are that rural and that out of the way, but in some ways he would get a better education because, you know, well, the teacher's teaching to all of these kids. And so it's a little young, smart boy. He's listening to the upper level stuff going on. And then when my wife and I homeschooled our kids and I began to notice that at first, you know, it was my wife's idea. I had always grown up in Christian school, but the Christian schools here weren't quite what they were. We didn't grow up in our Christian Reformed community here. And so my wife's like, well, I'd like to homeschool. And it's like, oh, okay. And so she's homeschooling the kids. And I eventually had you know, my time doing homeschooling with the kids too. But I began to notice that, you know, these kids in an hour or two would get pretty much get through all of kind of the basic, the math and the grammar and all that stuff. They could get through that stuff pretty quickly in terms of their education stuff. And I was worried, oh, they're going to be behind. And then I learned, no, they're not behind at all. And I realized that a lot of what's happening in schools is just a waste of time. And so basically, you know, and with an hour or two, my kids, if they were diligent at all, which they weren't always, could get their work done. And then it's like, you know, here, you can have an hour of computer time where you can play a little computer game or something. We'll have a little bit of educational TV time where we'll watch some science or some history thing and then read a book. And my kids read books. And they, some of my kids read lots of books. And it's like, you know, eventually they went into the public school system. And I think in many ways, the public school system wasn't helpful. and then I watched, you know, not all of my kids listened to me in terms of what college I told them they should have gone to. Some did, some didn't. But then I look at what's happening in the universities and suddenly I could understand what Jordan Peterson was so upset about. I think his third video that I watched was a conversation he had had at Harvard, which was basically saying, you know, let these people read books, let them read the classics, let them, as I see people leaving with university degrees, and I think they haven't read anything. They don't know anything. They haven't, you know, even if you're going to have them do all these studies things, at least have them have at least a track where they're reading some of the classics that are out there, but they don't know Plato or Aristotle or they don't know any history. They know nothing because, and this is sort of where this whole social justice thing has really gone to seed, because what they basically have is something analogous to the worst elements of my Christian school education, which, you know, we were kind of fed a line about Roman Catholics and kind of fed a line about non-Christians. And, you know, and if you're paying attention, you get outside, you begin to realize part of my Christian education has been propagandized. But at least with a Christian education, there's enough that so many of the important Christian figures throughout history were classicists. And so you'll bump into, you know, maybe Luther didn't like Aquinas, but you'll have to figure out what he was so upset about. And why is Aristotle a problem? And, you know, why is Plato the good guy? And who is Augustine? And, you know, as Lewis said, you know, you're gonna wind up bumping into people who are substantive and have made serious contributions and are dangerous, whether you've got a secular humanist propaganda or a Christian propaganda or now a new woke propaganda. You dig enough and you're going to wind up talking to a real philosopher. And even if he's one of the black hats, depending on where you're sitting, you're going to bump into, he's pushing against someone who's of substance. And there you know it. Now you're into the vein. Now you're into, well, you know, however we describe it, now you're into the thing, now you're into, as Steve Martin in Leap of Faith called, now you're into the genuine article. And as Lewis, once you get into that and once you get a taste for it, well, the propaganda is going to suffer if you have, you know, if you have any awareness or integrity or, you know, any blessing from God. So.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. That quote has always stuck with me. You know, he says, a young man cannot remain a sound atheist and well-read or something. Or yeah. One must be careful of what he reads if he wishes to remain a sound atheist.
That's right.
And I've found that to be the case as well, because like the more that I personally read, and like I would have killed for now, I would have loved to have had like the education that Lewis had, like going and sitting with like the great Knock, Kirkpatrick, and like having this tutor with you, like to have a tutor that was a genius basically, and to be able to like learn from them in like a one or two student environment, like, man, like I wish I had that, you know, like I wish I could do that. And so like now, I do a lot, like I do it on my own basically, you know, like I read the books and things like that, and I use the Great Courses a lot. I don't know if you ever heard of that.
Yeah. But, I use them a lot too. I love them.
Yeah. They're so good. And so I get a bunch of them. There's a sale on some right now, but.
Oh, really? Oh,
on Audible, I think. Yeah. They're like, some are for $5, I think, but, yeah, so I got a few of them. I can't remember them off the top of my head, but there's a one on classics that I got. And then they have one about the problem of evil and suffering, which is interesting. Most people, and more, I think, are they'll be so far removed from the idea of education being something other than being taught their sums, their maybe sometimes syntax. I wasn't even taught grammar in my public schooling, you know? And so it's like, which is a real, real, real pain for me right now. just like getting into it and like also not having to worry about being the best, because like another thing with like the education system now, it's like, there's so much of this comparison, like where are you as far as, you know, the national average or the state scores, or, you know, they have MAP testing, standardized testing, all these different types of tests that they administer to make sure that you're in line with all the other people of your age group. But it's like, you know, I don't always know how useful that is, especially like if you were to like, how do you quantify, like, okay, you could say, does he know the themes of the Brothers Karamazov? But it's like, but to reduce the Brothers Karamazov to that would be ridiculous. Like it would be, it would just be stupid, plain stupid, because the Brothers Karamazov speaks on more than like whether you know the themes or not. Like the Brothers Karamazov has like influenced, you know, millions of people to do, you know, to change their views, to become different, to aspire to different things. It's like, it's one of the most enlightening books that you can read. And like, to be like, to like, if you took a class on Dostoevsky, that may be all you get. And like, I've been listening, I guess Dostoevsky's top of mind, cause I've listened to like 6 lectures about him over the past couple of days. And, the guy's lecturing is very passionate about it, you know, like,
That's one of the Great Courses.
No, that one wasn't. I've been looking for one for that. This is on YouTube. Yeah. I can find the links and
send me the link. And,
yeah. Cause I've saved them. But he's studied Dostoevsky for like 50 years or something, you know, and like, he's talking about the Brothers Karamazov being like one of the single greatest books in history, at least in the past 200 years, you know? But he talks about it like in a way that you would talk about someone that you love, you know? And I don't think anyone will get that type of passion for something out of like their general curriculum or the required courses for the standard degrees, unless you're going into classics. I think it's unlikely that you'll develop the same level of passion that that guy was able to develop, or even like any other person who might read it for fun would develop, you know? And so it's like, I definitely like the way we're educated and the emphasis on the types of things we're educated, and then like the standardizing of our education, like are all serving to like, I can't help but think of about, I typically refer to C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy, but a lot of people, the classical parallel is 1984 by George Orwell. But I think that that Hideous Strength is like the Christian parallel to that book. I don't know if you ever read that Hideous Strength.
But I read it too many years ago, and you haven't been on the Bridges of Meaning Discord server yet, have you?
I have not. Yeah.
You haven't met the Randos United channel yet, have you?
No.
You see, here's the problem. You have now, by talking to me, come onto the radar screen of a community of people who are going to find you and want to talk to you. And this is how it begins.
Well, that's exciting.
You just mentioned Lewis's Space Trilogy, and they'll come after you. You'll see.
In a bad way or a good way?
In a good way. In a good way. in okay. a good way. Now, the so part of what, so we started a local meetup and the people here enjoyed it so much. And of course, I talked about it on my channel. And of course, people are spread out and they can't have a meetup to talk about these things. And so they, some of the people, some of the guys in our local meetup started the Bridges of Meaning Discord server. And that has gone really well, and a nice community has formed. And they'll be in the comment section, read the comment section. There's a link to an invite to the Discord server. Go to the Discord server, mention the Space Trilogy, and it will begin.
Awesome. That's good. Because that's another thing. No, when I say Space Trilogy, they're like, what? I didn't even know he wrote a Space Trilogy. And like, but that I read those books. I read them all, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 times. And like, it was such an impact. Like, it's such a good series. Like, such a relevant series too, you know, like, and a chilling series. Actually, like, it was very hard for me to finish that Hideous Strength first time through, because it was like, I was getting scared reading it, basically. Like, but eventually powered through, especially in like the, objectivity room, you know, where he has to step on the figure of Christ, you know, to desensitize himself to, you know, anything transcendent, basically. But yeah, so that's interesting. I'll be looking forward to these.
They are coming. They are okay. coming. I'm warning Excellent. You.
Excellent.
They're very nice. And they're, that's good. Well, and again, I mean, this whole, you know, finding, and I, the both the privilege and the liability of my position in this is that I've sort of been the gatherer. So I help people find each other, but I don't get to be in the room as much because I'm always helping people find each other. I'm doing my own things, but no, the Bridges of Meaning Discord server is a, people spend a lot of time on that too, but it's talking about, it's very clearly talking about the kinds of things that you're interested in. And so what has happened with you with respect to, so you mentioned you became a Christian, what has happened to you with respect to church? How has that gone for you?
Yeah. I found a church early on. It's like a non-denominational church. It was the church that was like at the beginning of my conversion, and I stayed there for a while. And then like, there are like a kind of like a multiplicity of reasons why I ended up leaving that church. But a large part of it was like, I had to start taking care of my dad a lot, basically. And so it's just like, takes up a lot of time, pretty much. He has had a TBI or traumatic brain injury. And so I at the beginning, I had to spend weeks basically with him. And it took a lot of my time, weekends, nights, and things like that. And so like, I just kind of grew away from it in that sense. And then also like my wife, worked Sundays a lot too. And so like, it was very difficult, to kind of get to be as connected as I was originally, just with like those pressures. And then by the time everything kind of really settled down, the COVID happened basically. And so then everything was online. It's like kind of hard to get involved in the church at that time. So like we've scouted a church. Like we see one that we want to go to. It's actually a Reformed church, but I can't remember what the exact name of it is at the top of my head right now. But like, I don't have a lot of, I don't know that I have a lot of like Reformed tendencies, because I've also been to like, we went to a lot of churches early on to kind of see what's what, and I can't stand like mega church environment, or like, there are a lot of churches that I just go to and I feel like I'm listening to some motivational Tony Robbins or Mel Brooks. I just feel like I'm listening to a motivational speaker basically. And I just can't stand it, you know? And so then I was like contemplating like, you know, there are a lot of other like more like liturgy focused places. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, that would be the absence of all those things that I hate. But like, also, I'm not too keen on some of those doctrinal teachings. And so then it's kind of like, just it's very difficult to find a good fit. But I think from what I've read about this church, I think it will be a good church once we're able to go to it. But so like, it was, and then also like just being in any in church environment, like I've just always been an anomaly, you know, so like sometimes I feel weird being in some environments, and like some people think I'm heretical. I've had some people think I'm not a Christian because I talk about, because I ask, you know, very difficult questions, like things that would make me doubt, you know, like Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov raises questions, do questions that raise doubts, you know, like you can't listen to that dialogue between Alyosha and Ivan whenever he brings up all those horrible, horrible stories about the little girl in the outhouse. I mean, I cried for hours after that. Like, you can't, you know, those are tough. Those, you have to address those questions, you know, like, And so, but like some people think it's almost heretical to say stuff like that, you know, it's like, and so that kind of puts a strain on that, those types of relationships. But for the most part, I've been able to find some people that I've been able to really connect with and that aren't estranged by the types of things that I'm interested in talking about, you know, but then they inevitably move away. It's like a friend of mine, I was good friends with, we meet up every Friday and talk about, we were reading through Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion. Yeah. And every Friday morning we meet up and talk about it. But then he moved away to Pennsylvania to go to seminary. Another friend of mine that I would meet up and talk with every like Thursday moved to Denver. And then like, you know, just like, people that I would talk with that were interested in these types of things eventually go off to do, you know, things, you know. So right now we believe we've found a church, but we just have to
and it's got to work for you and your wife, so
that's another thing, is like finding something that we both like, that both that resonates with both of us, you know, that we both find to be true. Well, that's the first thing that I go in. I'm like, are they saying anything that I find blatantly false? You know, like, is there anything that I'm like, ah, this is rubbing me the wrong way. You know, like, I don't like what he said there. Or I don't like, you know, that kind of stuff. But
No, it's tough. And people are, I mean, we started out the conversation talking about the fact that you have a hard time finding people who are like you. And so you're obviously not going to find a church of everyone like you. And so there's going to be compromises involved. But that's not a bad thing, because you grow in those areas. Because, you know, it's one thing to have this theory about loving people in loving people in general. I mean, of course, Dostoevsky talks about that quite a bit. You know, it's people are love. People are easy to love in theory. Meet a real human being and love that one. That's a whole different kettle of fish. They're inconvenient. They're obnoxious. They're brilliant. They're frustrating. They're, you know, and of course, that's why, you know, think what you want about the institution of marriage, but actually work a marriage is a whole different thing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It reminds me of, and you may be able to actually, okay, so I've told this story several times, but it was originally told to me by my logic professor, and I have not been able to find the source of this. And I fear that I might've remembered the name wrong, but you may be aware of where this comes from. But also, let me take a note because I want to circle back to something you said there. The story is essentially, he said, from what I remember, it was from St. Augustine, and it was something about the perfect life for the philosopher. And he says, perfect life for the philosopher is, would be something where he would live in a house, and he'd have someone in the house with him, an interlocutor, someone who is in the same field as him, but just a little bit better than him in every way. And so whenever they have conversations or debates, he's always getting outed, basically. He's always losing, basically, but just barely. Just barely, you know. So he always has to get higher and higher and higher and higher. And, you know, they spar up into the clouds, you know.
Right.
But also what's important in this house, so that they don't lock themselves away in an ivory tower of intellect and conversation, is that this house would contain people from every other area of life. They would have a spouse, they'd have kids, they'd have the gardeners, the cooks, the butlers, the, you know, they'd have all these people of varying skills and understandings and expertise, like all these different people from like that have just different understandings, you know? And so that's so that you can come back down basically, so that you have a stratified, a stratification of your understanding, basically, you know, it's like sort of like Richard Feynman's idea that you should be able to explain something at every level, you know, and that, that, it, that would be an indication of true understanding, you know? And so it's like you, so you, the philosopher gets all the benefit in the world from sparring with this really brilliant guy, but then he also has to, he has to go out and talk shop with the gardener, or, yep, you know, talk about, yep, everyday affairs with his wife, or, you know, things like that, you know? Yeah. And
I don't know who said it, but I've never heard it before, but I like it. Okay. And it's true. Yeah. And in a sense, the internet gives us some of that, mm-hmm, because, you know, we're talking now, and, yeah, and you can talk to other people, and,
yeah,
and yet at the same time, you don't have a lot of, you're not married to a philosopher, and you're taking care of your caregiver for your father. And even that is something to one who is paying attention. There's almost nothing you can't learn from.
That's very true. Yeah, and I, that's what I was kind of thinking. Like, I'd written down a note because you talked about loving in practice and Dostoevsky's quote on that, you know. And I think the best thing someone can do is be in a non-reciprocal relationship, you know, being like, whether that's with like a child or a dog or a disabled person or, you know, something like that. Like, there's something immensely, like, it just reminds me of, it reminds me of a practice the monks used to do where they would wear hair shirts under their clothes, you know, to remind them of the temperance of life. And like, so that they would never be comfortable in this world, you know? Yeah. Yeah. And so like caring for someone who can literally do nothing for you, I think is one of the most,
yeah,
I don't know, what do you call soul building things you, yeah, can do, you know? Yeah. Like, that's, and right. I didn't have that until I started caring for my father. Like,
yeah,
someone who literally he can't do anything for me, you know, it's, yeah, all give and no take basically, you,
yeah,
know, like,
yeah.
And so, and I think that's important. And a lot of people are, there's, that's sort of another common thing that's floating around where people are like, you should cut off toxic relationships and you should cut off, but the definition of toxic relationship is like another thing that's like, been put into water and diluted, you know, it's like, it's not a toxic relationship, is not an abusive relationship or a manipulative relationship. It's a relationship in which you get nothing from it, yes, you know, and
so, or it's like, an inconvenient relationship, a relationship, yeah, which challenges you in ways you don't want to be challenged.
Right. No, you're exactly right. You know, where it's like a relationship between someone and their mentor, you know, like they would think that in some sense that might be toxic because they're always criticizing what you do and that, yeah, kind of thing. But it's like, you know, that dissolution of true toxicity, like, it has robbed us from many edifying relationships we might otherwise have, you know. Yeah. Cause I, you know, people all the time, they're like, I got to go find myself. I got to go, you know, figure out who I am. And they leave their wife, their children, you know, their house, their job.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I don't think that's how you become what you are. I think you become who you're meant to be under immense pressure, you know, like, yeah, it's sort of like, yeah, oh, what did I'm reading, The Imitation of Christ by Thomas Kempis.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
I read it before bed, and,
yeah,
he talks about assuming as much pressure, as much burden, taking on as many things as you can take, basically, like as much as you can take, basically up until the point of cracking, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like that pressure is what exposes you for what you are, he says. Yeah. You know, it's like, yeah, it's not that you, and C.S. Lewis calls them rats in the cellar, you know. It's like, it's imagine you, there's a cellar and you have a basement or whatever, and you rush in quickly and you see all the rats scurrying about. The rushing in did not make the rats appear there. The rats were already there, you know. The rats were there to begin with, and the rushing in just exposed them, you know. You were able to see the rats, you know. So like being hungry, tired, you know, uncomfortable, those are the, that's the rushing in, you know.
Yeah,
that's the,
yeah, Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. No, it's growing in wisdom. It's growing in wisdom. And unfortunately, we have developed a society and are increasingly streamlining it But the irony with this whole privilege thing is that it is so often those, you know, blessed are the weak, blessed are the poor, because in a context of enormous affluence like we have today, the disabilities are opportunities to grow in wisdom and strength and power and beauty. And it's just the truth. It doesn't mean you will, but they're opportunities. And you find people who have taken advantage of the bad situation, of the growing up with lousy parents, of the bad neighborhood, the poor job, and have triumphed over these things and taken these troubles and spun them into gold. And it's still doable.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. And I'm taking this class on trauma as well. And previously I've read a couple books on this idea of post-traumatic growth. So traumatic events don't always earn a net negative, you know, like right. Traumatic events often provide they give you a framework for understanding people, you know, like if you were abused as a child, you won't grow up thinking that everybody is an angel, basically, you know, like you get to, and so, you know, that child who was abused may grow up to develop, a better ability to read people, understand people, like better mechanisms of defending themselves in their family, that kind of things. But then there's also like, there are a lot of what are called like the intangible benefits of trauma, you know, like, which they refer to as wisdom, understanding, mental fortitude and resistance, that types of thing. So like if you experience trauma and you're able to, one of the core factors of your ability to turn trauma into something good is your ability to apply a framework of meaning to it. And so like, if you have a way of meaning making that can turn a traumatic event into something, what you might say edifying, you know, like, then you have a higher chance of benefiting from that trauma, you know, like, or if your framework already includes like the Christian narrative is that people are inherently flawed in some way, you know, like to what degree people have speculated on forever, you know, whether it's completely or partially or not, you know, whatever, but the idea is that people are flawed in some way, all people, you know, like the billionaire, the healthiest man in the world, like they're all flawed in some way, you know, like, whereas like in modernity or the people in modern times, they think that if you give someone enough wealth, health, and happiness, they'll be good. They'll be a good person, you know, like, but that, and that's what, and G.K. Chesterton notes this too, is Christianity gives you the ability to criticize the aristocrat, you know, it gives you the ability to criticize the king. It gives you the ability to criticize the millionaire, billionaire, you know,
yeah.
Because it states off at the beginning that all have fallen short, you know?
Yep. Yep.
So, but that meaning that framework, and as that, and we've noted before, like the framework is dissolving for meaning, you know, to frame things in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
And so, which would speak to that coddling of the American mind that Jonathan Haidt talks about, you know, like as our ability to place things in a framework of meaning dissolves, so will our ability to positively internalize traumatic events.
Yeah.
And so that means, that's how you get microaggressions, and that's how you get trigger warnings, and that's how you get things, you know, of that nature, is because like, since our framework for meaning is dissolved so much, like, the bar for traumatic events just gets lowered and lowered and lowered, you know, like, whereas someone like Solzhenitsyn can literally write, bless you prison for being in my life. Yeah. You taught me so much, like, there on your prison mat straw, I learned the secrets of the human soul. And it's like stuff like that, you know, like, I don't like that. That's such, or Viktor Frankl's in his Man's Search for Meaning, you know, being confronted with naked bare existence or naked existence, you know, like, that is the highest, that's one of the highest traumatic events you can experience, you know?
Yeah.
And he was able to internalize it and then found the school of logotherapy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and make meaning and place it in a framework of meaning rather.
Yeah.
And, but that skill is being lost for a lot of the things that we've talked about here, education, upbringing, like the value system of modern times, the secularization of modern times, all sorts of, you know, that kind of stuff.
Very true. Very true.
Well, we've been talking for about an hour and a half now.
I told you I go long.
Yeah. I could go much, much longer, I'm sure. I've had a crushing headache for about 45 minutes.
Oh, right. No.
That's why I keep pressing on my forehead. Cause it's
man. Oh, that's brutal.
But,
we can call it here. That's fine.
I think we got to a lot of good ground, I think. And, we could always continue in the future.
Well, like I said, you will, I will post this on my channel and people will see it, and I'll send you the link to the Discord because they will want to find you and someone will want to talk to you. And that's how this goes.
Well, that's exciting. I'll be looking forward to that.
Well, good. Well, I hope you can do something about your headache.
I took an Excedrin before we started talking, but it seems to have failed me or something.
Oh boy. Well, you take care of yourself, Adam, and take care of your father and your wife. And I wish you well in terms of your church search. It's a horrible time to look for churches because I don't know how things are there, but things remain quite shut down here. So it's, but at the same time, then everything's on the internet. So you can kind of get a little window. So there's always upsides. Yeah.
Likewise, it was great talking with you. I really enjoyed our time, the conversation we were able to have, all of it. It was excellent.
Good, good. Well, take care. It was a pleasure to meet you, Adam.
Yeah, nice to meet you too.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.